his legendary pacemaker as he plays a few songs from the soundtrack of his life. Only on The Sweet Spot, this Thursday, March 23rd at 10 p.m. WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored community radio.
On Saturday, March 25th and Sunday the 26th, come to a national conference for the full normalization of relations between the United States and Cuba. Plenaries and workshops include voices from the U.S., Cuba, and Canada, developing joint strategies for ending the U.S. blockade and finishing the process towards normalization begun in 2014. And on Saturday night, a public program at the Shabazz Center in Harlem includes Puerto Rican hero Rafael Kinsel Miranda, Sandra Ramirez Rodriguez, director of the North American desk of Cuba's Friendship Institute, and founder of the Antonio Maceo Brigade, Andres Gomez. Music by Cuban jazz pianist Marcelo Casagrande and the Afro-Boricua drum and dance ensemble, Bombayo. That's March 25th through the 26th, a national conference for the full normalization of relations between the U.S. and Cuba at the Fordham University Law School, 62nd Street off Broadway in Manhattan. For registration and information, log on to www.nationalcubaconference.org.
Now, during the fun drive, you don't have to keep calling back because of busy signals or have to pull over to the side of the road or miss the show you were listening to in order to make your pledge.
Blah, 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 blah.
Now you can donate and choose your thank you gift online at your convenience at any time. Go to the new WBAI online donation site at www.givetowbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. You can also pledge in the name of your favorite show, choosing it from the drop-down menu, and whether you would like to be thanked on the air. Just go to www.give2wbai.org.
And in case you couldn't tell, you are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City. WBAI broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Our guest this morning will be Sally Wiener-Rata, author, photographer, entrepreneur, cool person. Stay tuned. Thank you. music from the soundtrack of the motion picture Silent Running, music by the wonderful Peter Schickele. No, not in his PDQ Bach persona, but rather in his Peter Schickele persona. So, Sally Grotta is our guest via Skype. Some of it is pre-recorded. We'll explain all that in a bit. But because it's Skype and because I never trust how this thing works, I am going to call her first and make sure that she is online. Ah, okay. Those are good noises. Hey there, Sally.
Hi there.
Ooh, it works. It works.
Wow. And I'm so impressed.
Yeah, and it really is so much better voice quality than phone, I gotta say. I'm not a big Skype fan, but you know, I've done God knows how many interviews on the phone and talked to you just moments ago on the phone, and the sound is clear. I like it.
Well, I'm glad you like it, since you're my expert on sound.
Uh-huh. Okay. I have good ears. I am not the expert on the technologies here at WBAI, and it was a long time. We had Skype for a long time, but it was that we could have a person on Skype talk to us on the air, but we couldn't talk to them.
What good is that?
What you could do, actually, is I could wear a headset like you're wearing, mm-hmm, and at the same time that I'm wearing the headset, and you would hear me through the headset, I would still have to talk into a microphone. So, you know, two mics at the same time, basically, one for each purpose.
Yes.
And that is... dumb. But now I can use what passes for a mic. I'm actually using a guest mic. The normal host microphone seems to be in tatters, so I'm using the guest mic. It sounds better. And the headphones I normally use to be on the air, and lo, there you are.
Marvelous.
So
marvelous that technology sometimes works.
Sometimes, intermittently. Let me do announcements before we do our chat, talk, interview, whatever you may call it. But I really only have one major announcement to make, and it involves you.
Oh.
Well, you're the driver.
Okay.
You are literally driving the event that occurs on April 1st.
Yes, I am.
And that took a second, right? But in this very building, I'm on the third floor, but the New York Review of Science Fiction readings occur on the first floor at 388 Atlantic Avenue, usually the first Tuesday of every month, which in April would be April 4th. But we're going to fool people by going on April 1st. And we've done April 1st readings before, but we usually did them in order to justify having a comedy event. And this is not a comedy event. This is merely a joyful event, because April 1st is also the birthday of Samuel Ray Delaney, a.k.a. Chip. Only I can't say that nobody calls him Sam. Because one time when Chip was on Hour of the Wolf, we're talking now in the mid-70s, and the person following me was Jeff Greenfield, who has, you know, since has been a big mach on PBS and CBS, and he's got several political books out, and he worked on John Lindsay's campaign and all kinds of stuff. He's a political pundit, and his show followed mine. And I had Chip on the air. He came in like 5 minutes before, which is a good time to come in and start setting up. And he takes one look and he says, Sammy? Really? Well, they were in the Bronx High School of Science together. And I'd never heard anybody call Samuel R. Delaney Sammy before or since.
childhood names do carry through our lives, don't they?
I guess so. But it was a charming moment, actually. And it was very interesting because Delaney and Greenfield told me all about that class and the various people in that class. And there's whole bunches of people who were in that class at particular graduating year at the Bronx High School of Science. And half of them are famous today, mostly for good reasons.
Fabulous.
So it is not. So April 1st is not only Chip Delaney's birthday. It's his 75th birthday. It's his diamond. I like saying, you know, rather than saying 75th, because that makes him sound old.
Which he certainly is not.
He is not. He is not. So rather I see this as the diamond birthday. Right? If a queen gets a diamond jubilee.
Well, it's appropriate. He has such a sparkling personality.
Ooh, absolutely. And so many facets to it.
Yes, no question about that.
Badumch. So, I used to have a little electronic machine that has a rim shot. I mean, I still have it, but you should all be grateful that I left it at home. But anyway, April 1st, 388 Atlantic Avenue, 7 p.m. Doors open at 6:30. I think we're going to fill up. Judging from the reaction, I only started the publicity in earnest yesterday, and I'm getting, you know, lots of retweets and repostings on Facebook and people clicking, oh yeah, I'm coming, and even more people clicking, they're interested, and everybody should come here to 388 Atlantic Avenue to meet and greet one of the most important science fiction writers of any generation so far. I should say speculative fiction, because so much of what he writes is fantasy. I consider Dahlgren his masterwork science fiction, but I had Lester Del Rey on the air years ago screaming, this is not science fiction. This is crap like that Thomas Pynchon guy. Yeah, okay, I'll go along with that. Yeah, you know, it's crap like that Thomas Pynchon guy. The guy who wrote a book called Gravity's Rainbow, where the sun goes nova on the first page.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that kind of.
Also, his nonfiction, his critical work is fascinating.
The Motion on Light on Water, The Jewel Hinged Jaw. Mm-hmm. I'm doing this without benefit of bio in front of me because there's almost no need. But I will tell another often told anecdote, which is that I began working as a phone volunteer during a fundraising drive at WBAI in 1967 when I was 13 years old. And WBAI had a drama and literature director. We had a drama and literature department, but we had a director by the name of Baird Searles. And those people who really know their science fiction history know that Baird was the movie critic for Galaxy magazine and the book critic for the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, and was producing radio dramas in the 60s when radio was considered dead and there was nothing but news and music on the radio. And Baird was also the very first person to ever broadcast anything for what we would call the gay community, but he, with his incredible voice, called the homosexual community in 1963. That's guts.
Mm-hmm.
1963. And he had an entourage. of people that wrote for him and produced for him. And there was this guy named Theodore Sturgeon, and there was this guy, Thomas M. Dish. There was a script girl. That was her job title, script girl, named Joanna Russ. But the project of the moment was The Star Pit, written and narrated by Samuel R. Delaney.
Marvelous.
And I was 13 and he was 25.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the most important person to that production because somebody had to go get the coffee. Somebody had to fill the water glasses when people were ready for the water glasses. Somebody had to, well, roll the joints. But it was the 60s.
Early skills.
It was the 60s. And that's how I met Chip. And I have been a reader and I was already a fan because I had been reading his stuff. The Star Pit that he was producing had already won the Nebula Award.
Mm-hmm.
And what he has done to the field before that, he wrote Babel 17, he wrote The Einstein Intersection, The Ballad of Beta 2, not up to the standards of those other two books. And then in 1975, he published Dahlgren. He wrote it over about a three-year period. And it is a masterwork. And he's written a lot of brilliant stuff since, including criticism. He was instrumental in 1977 to the science fiction community of writing possibly the definitive review of a movie called Star Wars.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was published in Locus, which is sort of the trade magazine of record. Would you say that's fair, the trade magazine?
Yeah, that would be a good description of Locus.
Yeah, it's the trade it's trade magazine of record for the science fiction community, and Delaney wrote this fascinating, brilliant, not totally gushing, it was a great analysis essay on Star Wars that helped endear a science fantasy movie to the science fiction community.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So many things Chip has done, and through all,
and now he's embraced Facebook so completely. And if you follow him on Facebook, he will often have fascinating commentary, lengthy commentary on his Facebook posts.
Yes.
And criticisms.
Yes,
critiques.
There are few people. There's him. There's mm-hmm. David Gerald.
Yes, David does a marvelous job.
Who I finally met and got to interview at Heliosphere 2 weeks ago. And I'll be broadcasting that shortly, by the way. Probably early April. And Julius Lester, formerly of WBAI. Those three people. Oh, and the cartoonist Sandra Poynton.
Mm-hmm.
When I want to feel good, I check out those four people on Facebook. And they have something uplifting or fascinating or whatever to say. And they don't tend to mention President Voldemort. So, so it's calming. So to wrap up, April 1st, Saturday, 7 p.m. starts at 7 p.m. Arrive earlier. At the Brooklyn Commons Cafe, we seat about 100 to 120 people, and I'm hoping it'll be full. And if you, the listeners, come, well, then we're sure to be full. And Delaney is, we're going to have an essay about Dahlgren, performed by Terrence Taylor, who did an amazing thing last year. You want to find out what? Well, come to the reading or watch it, by the way, on I don't want to say this too much. Yeah, you can watch it without coming here. It's on live stream, okay? Get over it. I want you to come here. I don't care where you live. Come here.
It's much more fun that way.
It's
anyway.
It's a party. It's a birthday party.
We're having
party.
A birthday party.
We are.
It's going to be a delight.
We are. We're going to be serving all this sugary stuff to these diabetics. Both Chip and I are diabetic. Getting an apple cake. But that's a secret. Don't tell anybody on the air. And I have to figure out how to do something for the audience, but I'm going to talk to the owner of the cafe about that. We'll do something. Admission is free. Donations are accepted. In fact, cajoled. In fact, we would like if you could donate $7. But if you don't have the money, you will not be turned away. If you donate nothing, you are welcome.
Also, if you're hungry, the cafe does produce some very nice food.
They do. They actually do.
I was surprised at how pleasant it was.
Yeah, but they stopped serving salmon burgers.
Oh.
They didn't want to keep frozen stuff. Mm. They like their food to be very fresh, and the salmon burgers had to be frozen. So it took longer to make, and it didn't always. At first, they would have to defrost it in the microwave, then put it into the oven.
Sure.
So it's off the menu, but they have other burgers, including a lot of vegetarian fare. Beer, wine, coffee, whatever.
Delicious pastries,
which I cannot partake of, but I have been told excellent soup.
Oh yes,
excellent soup and nice sandwiches. So you can come early, have a meal, have your meal during intermission if you like. What I suggest when you come in, order your food, and they'll serve it to you during intermission. That's a crafty way of doing it. And I hope that people will hang out after the reading is over. I was mentioning, Terrence Taylor is going to perform an essay that was published in Lightspeed magazine. And then Chip and I will have a chat, an interview. Then we'll intermish. After intermission, Chip will read a brand new yet unpublished short story. And if there is time, we will either do some Q&A from the audience, or we're just going to start celebrating.
And usually your audiences are also filled with fascinating people.
Oh,
it's so worth coming.
It really is. There are two readings in New York, two reading series. One of them is the KGB Fantastic Fiction series, and the other is the New York Review of Science Fiction series. And the KGB series, I like to make this comparison, and Ellen Datlow has finally made peace with it. The KGB series is like a salon.
Mm-hmm.
Every face in the room, everybody there is famous. It's a famous editor, publisher, writer. The cream of the crop of science fiction are in the audience, not to mention reading at KGB. And ours is more like a performance space.
Mm-hmm.
And we do a certain amount of interactive, but KGB, you not only go to see great readers, but also to rub elbows at our place. You go for a show. I think that's a fair. And now we're a TV show,
mm-hmm.
since
mm-hmm.
we're on live stream. And we have three cameras. Terrence Taylor does a very, very good job, but he and I will be switching off the engineering duties at night. I'll be engineering when he's on stage and versa visa. And the reason that this is so important to mention while Sally is on the phone on the air here is Sally is driving Chip down.
Well, we both are from Philadelphia, and we enjoy riding together on the we have wonderful conversations in the car.
I am so annoyed that he moved to Philly.
I'm so pleased.
Well, he had this incredible apartment since I met him. That was 1967. And then about like a year ago, I just see on Facebook, well, I've moved to Philadelphia. And it's like, so I can't just call you up on a Wednesday and say, come to the station and be on the show.
Right, right.
Habrumpf.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been to parties at his place many years ago. I babysat his daughter there at the time that he was married to Marilyn Hacker, primarily for the purpose of raising that said daughter.
Yes.
Named Alex, A-L-Y-X, named after a Joanna Russ character, as a matter of fact.
Oh.
Alex Hacker Delaney. And so that apartment, you know, for me had great significance in the fact that for many, many years I would run into Chip in bookstores, on the subway, wasn't necessarily, you know, and on the street, we would just run into each other all the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And once he started working at Temple University, actually before that, when he was at University of Massachusetts at Amherst, mm-hmm, at the same time, oh, the aforementioned Julius Lester was the chaplain there.
Hmm.
Now, people should know that Julius Lester was a notable member of the Black Panthers.
Mm-hmm.
I think a charter founding member of the Black Panthers.
I didn't realize that.
Yes, nowadays he's a rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
And he is, and he has been for quite a few years. And at that university, he was the chaplain. He was the reb. He was the rabbi. Which is another reason why he's so wonderful to read on Facebook. And this is a man who can sing you a slave spiritual or the Kol Nidre.
Well, anybody who can sing the Kol Nidre can sing anything.
Yeah, well, he's got a few records out on Folkways.
Mm-hmm.
And those are mostly spirituals, but he can do the call. But then I saw him on Channel 13 in a show about the Jewish diaspora, and there he was doing the Kol Nidre.
Yeah.
When I say Channel 13, that's the local PBS station in New York. So so Julius and Chip were there at the same time, and Julius and Chip were at WBAI at the same time in 67. So... But what of that? The point is that these are extraordinary people, and Chip is one of the most extraordinary, and by the way, nicest, sweetest people, and a man who broke so many barriers. Graciously.
He always with such grace. There's nothing confrontational about him. He just is, and he's interested in everybody else. And I didn't know him when he was young, but I can't imagine him not having done it with kindness and just being himself and being honest.
And with a smile.
Oh,
and
that
charming smile.
And
he can be very serious, and I've seen him angry.
I'm sure.
And, when Dahlgren and some of his books were... had been in print for years and years and years, mm-hmm, at a particular publisher, and all of a sudden a homophobic editor came in there, and all of a sudden, for the first time in umpteen years, it was not in print, I saw Chip get mad.
I can imagine.
And rightfully so. And even...
And how foolish of that publisher to let that editor do that.
Oh, God. it was overturned.
Oh, good.
But now, most of Chip's books are, I think, with Wesleyan?
I don't know.
I think so. The university took proper interest in him and did gorgeous editions of his books. I had all first edition paperbacks, and they got lost in a flood. But that's another story. Just two weeks ago.
I'm sorry to hear that, Jim.
Oh, God. 2 weeks in a day.
That's a heartbreak.
It really is. I only lost about 10% of my books, but it was an important 10%, including my first edition, Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
Not my Dahlgren. I have my Dahlgren. But my Babel 17 and The Tides of Lust, Chip's first but not only porn novel. That one is very rare. That was published by Lancer Books, I think, who like only existed for about 2 years. And it was a hard to find book when it was in print, but I got a copy. I think I got it from Chip.
Marvelous.
And it's gone. It's gone. Anyway, people have heard me play the Star Pit on the air quite a few times. I also produced my, a radio drama with Chip. It ran only 2.5 hours called, ooh, it's in the back of Tales of Neverion. It's one of the appendices, and it's called A Tale of Plague and Carnivals, and it's a surreal look at AIDS, written in about 1986. And we did that as a, I shouldn't call it a radio drama, but we had about 6 readers, with Chip being the primary narrator. And I always wanted to do a radio version of We and Some Strange Powers Employ Move on a Rigorous Line. That's just the title. His short stories are spectacular. And novellas. That's a novella. It would make great radio.
Well, I look forward to hearing it.
Yeah, well, so do I. If we ever have a radio station again with studios where I can produce radio drama, or if I can talk to people that I work with out in California, who, by the way, did produce an audiobook version of Dahlgren. There is an audiobook of Dahlgren from Skyboat Media available on Amazon or wherever audiobooks are sold. And it's quite a production, with Stefan Rutnicki being the lead voice on that. I think it took them like 2 months to produce, and they're fast. They do the Lightspeed Magazine podcast, which I'm the host of. And they put out my audiobook called Chatting Science Fiction.
Lovely.
So, enough of that. I'm sorry, but I had to gush. I think the proper word is cavil.
Yes.
Because this is a cool event, and I'm very proud that we're doing
it. It's very cool that you put it together. And a lot of people are going to enjoy celebrating Chip's birthday with you.
And it's very cool that he accepted, because I'm sure he had a lot of offers as to what to do on that birthday. But I asked him first about 2 years ago.
Oh,
I knew it was coming. I got my dibs. So, and I just every con I would see him, because Chip can be quite forgetful, and he'll always say, "Don't forget to remind me." So I did so constantly. And it is happening. I'm very, very pleased. And you're helping make it happen by being his escort, along with his partner, Dennis.
Yes, yes.
Well, Dennis is accompanying him. You're the escort.
Aw.
Well, it's true.
Thank you.
And when in New York, readers of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings stay at Chateau Kesselbaum. And I won't say more about that.
And do not call to ask where that is. It is private.
There are about 5 people in the world who would get that. I hope they're all listening. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, Jim. Well, that was a good wake up half hour for me. Now I'm awake and ready to chat more loquaciously than I have the past 20 minutes.
Good. So, JoJo, the Winter Boy. JoJo is not speculative fiction.
No, it is not.
Winter Boy is.
Yes.
Both are from Pixel Hall Press, which we had a program about before when, where was it? Was it a ReaderCon where I interviewed you and your sadly late husband, Daniel?
I believe it was ReaderCon, and actually you interviewed Daniel because he was the publisher back then.
But you were in the room, I think.
Yeah, I was taking pictures and listening to two fascinating men talk.
Yeah, and by the way, Daniel Grotta is one of the best Tolkien scholars of all time, and I'm not slack on that.
Thank you.
The only way I can one-up it is I once got to speak to Tolkien, but that's it. It's true. Yeah. For about 5 minutes, I asked him about some pronunciations for a radio piece with Baird, the aforementioned Baird Searles. But anyway, you are author of The Winter Boy and JoJo.
Right.
You haven't published as much short fiction, have you?
No, I haven't, because I'm a slow writer. And if I'm going to be slow, I might as well be slow with a long work.
Okay.
I've had a piece in North Atlantic Review, which was not speculative. I'm working on a couple of short stories. I also often incorporate what other people would consider short stories in my fiction, in my long books. For instance, there are the teaching tales in The Winter Boy, which are really standalone short stories.
It makes one think that there's sort of a, what's the word, something happening with Left Hand of Darkness, in which Le Guin, and by the way, that takes place on the world called Winter, in which Le Guin had these wonderful folk tales.
Exactly.
That established sort of the backstory for the planet.
Well, very much. To me, the mythology of a culture is integral to the story. The teaching tales are the history of the society that I've created, but they're also used to help create dialogues with the young men who are the students in The Winter Boy, so that they can learn. Since story is the way we as human beings learn.
So tell us a précis of The Winter Boy.
Okay. It is set in what I call a Neverwhen society. So it is, people like calling it post-apocalyptic, but it's not like typical post-apocalyptic fiction. It is a society in which a band of widows have gathered together to create civilization out of chaos. And they do so by training the young men who will be leaders, and men are still primarily the leaders who go out. The women are the leaders who stay within. They train the young men using storytelling, Socratic dialogue, reason, there's no magic in it, and sexual intimacy. So a widow will be, they're called Alesha, and a single one is Alesha. And Alesha will be coupled with one boy for a season, therefore the Winter Boy, and train him in being a full human being, a leader, a conflict resolution expert, or whatever is needed from that young man. They also, with the Alesha and the Alamon, what these young men become, together form the government of the society. The story itself is about a young woman who believes in the peace, the civilization they've created, with all her heart and soul. She is a comparatively young widow, therefore in her 40s. And she is coupled with a boy for her first boy. Her winter boy, Rill, And she starts out very idealistically, believes thoroughly in the peace. And little by little, she uncovers conspiracies, discovers that the people that the women in particular that she's most dependent upon all her life in guiding her, that not everybody is who they appear to be, that there are some very definite failings and cracks in the civilization. And then she discovers that she has been manipulated throughout her life to this point, and she has to decide whether she's going to continue. In the meantime, some of the ruptures that are occurring, she realizes she is the key to perhaps try to save the civilization if it is worth saving, and if it is worth saving the boy.
Right.
Does that give? Is that a? I did that off the cuff. How was that, Jim?
It's excellent. It's excellent. It sets it up very nicely. Now, that would normally be a great segue into which play your reading of chapter one, which we will be hearing soon. But I'd like to talk about other aspects of your career. Or do you want to go straight to the reading?
Other aspects are fine. However, you're the expert in this. I would love to chat a bit with you.
Okay. You are just a bit of a photographer.
Just a bit.
Yeah. Let me explain. I met you and Daniel very early 90s, I think, at Ziff Davis.
Right.
When I was working on ZiffNet, not to be confused with ZDNet.
Yes.
ZiffNet was available on CompuServe and Prodigy. People remember Prodigy out there? I don't think so. And I was the giver of accounts.
Yes, you were.
But I couldn't give out accounts to everybody. It was a problem because we had like 100 accounts to give to 200 people.
Yep.
But that's how I met. Is that you came into my cube. Or did I actually have an? I think I had an office for about a month, and it was within the magazine. My office was. I was the only ZiffNet person in New York. Everybody else was in Cambridge because they were working with some guy named Tim Berners-Lee, who had this stupid idea to create something called the World Wide Web.
Yeah.
Nothing ever came of it.
No, obviously.
Yeah, and...
Daniel and I were contributing editors at PC Magazine, essentially by virtue of the fact that we were among the few who were actually experts on digital imaging and digital photography at the time. We wrote the first major book on it. And the reason we were the experts on that is when I'm a professional photographer, and... By the way, Daniel taught me photography, and one who's traveled
all over the world, we should mention.
Yeah. And we've had some wild adventures traveling on assignment. And when I saw the first digital camera that I saw, it wasn't even digital back then, but it was electronic camera. I knew that's what I wanted to do. So we wrote the first major book on the subject, and somehow out of that, we segued into the tech world. From the feature, we were very involved in glossy magazines at the time and doing feature writing and location stories for trips to Antarctica, Amazon jungle, Papua New Guinea, all over the place. I mean, I was so ready to write science fiction with all the alien cultures I've experienced. And because we were considered among the big experts in digital photography and imaging, PC Magazine brought us on board.
Yeah, it's I went to your place once after you had a disaster.
Yes, a flood.
Yeah,
because of a roofer. Yes.
Yeah, and I saw the setup that you had to determine the temperature of colors.
Yes, yes.
And you know, we're talking about something that would not fit into a New York apartment. It was like a shed. Just to do that wouldn't that be inaccurate?
Yeah, we've taken it down since then because we're not doing that kind of testing. But we had what we called the black cube. Yes.
Yeah.
It was inside our studio. To explain, I live in an old Oddfellows Hall in the Poconos, which is northeast Pennsylvania's mountains, about 2 hours outside of New York City. And so this is loft space in the country, and we had room for, I guess it was a 15 by 15 by 15 black cube.
Yeah.
Where we could black out all light and control light perfectly, and therefore be able to do some very sensitive testing of cameras and other equipment regarding color.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, color has become really very reliable in the digital world, and that kind of testing is no longer needed. So that section of my studio is now my production center for my exhibition prints, which can be quite large.
Yeah.
I have a 44-inch G-Clay printer here that HP gave me in support of one of my big projects. And so I have a big mat cutter and where I really do my preparation of my prints in that area where the cube was. I love large prints.
Oh God, yes. About the only thing I can say to that is ooh.
Yeah, and I experiment on different media. I'm playing around with experimenting on printing on spun silk right now, which is quite fascinating.
Spun silk.
I have to use paper underneath it because it's so porous and I don't want to mess up my printer. And so I end up with these interesting negative images on the white paper and then other images on the silk. I particularly like doing it on gold spun silk.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, fun stuff. So if you see lots of visual information in my fiction, people say that they can actually see the world that I write about. It's because that's the way I think. I'm a very visually oriented person. So when I describe a scene, I'm seeing that it's in my mind's eye. And so I'm just looking for the words that will create the same kind of pictures that I create visually with pixels.
Yeah. Yeah. And therefore, by the way, Pixel Hall Press.
Yep. Daniel liked that image.
Yeah. It no pun intended. It's a very descriptive name.
And that's
something of what we were talking about at that time during that interview. What was that, about 5 years ago?
Yes. Daniel had quite a vision. You know, he was a longtime editor and critic, member of the National Book Critics Circle, and he had a vision of this is before a lot of people were doing small press. He wanted to create a small press that could have a handful of really superb writers that he could put some effort into promoting, the kind of authors that are often lost in the big houses, which we well know because we were published by several of the big guys, you know, McGraw-Hill and Grosset and Dunlap and, you know, a whole bunch of them. And certain kinds of authors are simply lost. A single press release is put out the first day, a publication, usually by a PR person who hasn't even read the book.
Oh, yeah.
And we wanted to do something more. And so Daniel decided to create this press. Happily, there are many other small presses that now exist. And so he was a bit of a pioneer in it.
Yeah. Yeah, he absolutely was.
As in many other things.
Yeah. And What have you published besides your fiction, you and Daniel, in Pixel
Hole?
Oh,
my goodness. I think it's about 8, 9, or 10 nonfiction books on a variety of subjects, including photography, of course. I guess well over 1,000 articles. We traveled all over the world on assignment and had a wild adventures. I mean, I've been on the high wire at the circus, a lot of participatory journalism, came face to face with a 25-foot crocodile in Kenya, visited with the Samburu warriors.
Right. Yeah, there are some amazing photographs of you with the warriors there.
Yeah.
I believe there were some awards involved there, weren't there?
Yeah, a few. Okay. Yeah, I've been very lucky. I've been in the right place at the right time many times. I've had some amazing editors.
May I add, with the right skill set?
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's all storytelling, and it comes back to what I believe, that this is how we communicate, this is how we learn, this is how we live through story. Even our memories are our personal mythologies, the stories we tell ourselves about our lives. It's hardwired into us as human beings. So I just try to find meaningful stories in my life that I like to share. And the whole idea is the communication and sharing. That's what means the most to me.
I don't know what to say. It's the best metaphor or best rationale, I think, there we go, rationale for writing, whether fiction, yeah, nonfiction, visual, radio, what have you, that I can imagine.
Yeah, it's I'm right now preparing for a fun kind of event that I was invited to in Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is actually the big city nearest my home in the Poconos. And unusually, unexpectedly, when we moved here, I had no idea that it was quite an art center. And I'm preparing for this intimate literary tea that we're having for Women's History Month. And I'm doing a talk about living the creative life. And I feel that learning how to tell stories, however you can do it, you know, through quilting, through painting, through raising children, however you can learn to tell stories, energizes the mind to be able to be problem solving and a creative business person, a creative person to live just a good life. So I'm doing this talk about living the creative life, and I'm having fun preparing for it. When one thinks about all the things that are creative, I use that also as part of something else I'm doing, which is, I guess I have to backtrack a bit. The other novel you mentioned, JoJo, it is a mainstream novel. It was a Jewish Book Council Network book, which pleased me a great deal. Story of a mixed-race Jewish woman raised by her white Christian grandparents in a small Poconos village, which is entirely white, entirely Christian, and she learned to hate the place. She walks away from it to go to university, vowing never to return. The novel itself is set about 17 years later, when she returns to the village for 1 week to bury her grandmother, get rid of the family estate, and hopefully never return again. And during that 1 week, she runs into the white boy who broke her heart, the bully from her childhood who threatens worse, and uncovers a secret that her grandmother kept from her that makes her question the nature of the prejudice that formed who she is as a woman. What surprised me about this novel, you know, I simply came up with a story. Yes, I put my whole heart and soul into all my stories. So usually there is some philosophical aspect or social aspect to my stories. But what surprised me is that people have been using JoJo as a point of discussion, as a starting point to discuss issues of prejudice and bias and misunderstandings. And it has launched a whole new career for me that is just beginning to take off through my new website, crossingthetribaldivide.com, in which I talk about how much we need to hear the stories from other viewpoints. I need to hear people tell me their story, even if I disagree with them, because that stimulus of hearing somebody else's story, of sharing it, can create a synthesis that creates new ideas and new stories, new products, new ways of coming up with answers to problems that is essential to a healthy community, healthy life, healthy economy. So this whole thing snowballed out of a novel.
Yeah.
Which surprised the daylights out of me.
Yeah, fact-following semi-fiction.
Right. Well, it was fiction. The novel was completely fiction.
Well,
it was completely fiction, as much as any fiction is. Yes, there's roots in stories that I picked up or experiences I had, but that's what all fiction is. We're vampires, you know. Novelists are vampires. We pick up stories from everywhere. Excuse me.
Yeah, that's true.
And when we combine them and they sit in this stew inside us that I call my creative chaos, and things bubble up, characters bubble up, and plots bubble up, and out of that somehow, after years and years of rewrites and rewrites and rewrites, it becomes a novel that people can enjoy and sometimes get something more out of than just entertainment, because that's what we crave out of story. We crave to learn. We crave to experience. And we crave to put ourselves into story. When we're reading, isn't that what we're doing? That's why reading's interactive, whereas watching TV or a movie is passive, because the book I write is not the book you read. You bring something else to that book.
That's true. That's true. I would say, you know, the number one interactive experience is reading the written word. I think the number two is listening to the spoken word, because you're it is set a certain way and it's all dependent on the narrator, but it's still interactive insofar as the mind's eye is concerned.
Yes, yes. Especially if it's a wonderful voice reciting beautiful words, you get lost in them and you're transported to wherever that voice is taking you. But it's that voice that builds the world in your own mind, using the bricks and the earth and the mud of your own mind.
Yeah,
and to build that.
And next comes theater, I dare say.
Yes.
Then
yes.
Movies, then at the bottom of the heap, television.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's very, very passive. And that's why the only thing I use TV for is to go to sleep.
Yeah, well, I was telling you.
I don't have broadcast or cable TV, but I use Netflix and Amazon Prime to go to sleep.
Yeah, those are good. I have discovered the joys of a lot of brilliant stuff on YouTube and live stream.
Yes, yes, definitely.
Both of which are free services. And I was telling you off the air, and at some point I'm going to have to do a whole show about this on the air, my new obsession, Safari Live. which is a show broadcast live twice a day, each episode 3 hours. So it's 6 hours a day, 365 days a year. Holidays don't matter. They always do it live out of Africa on a bona fide camera safari. Two jeeps and one person walking the bush. And it's just addictive and exhilarating and funny. And by the way, the guides, the safari guides, are characters.
Oh, well, they always are. When you do go to Africa, the sometimes the tall tales they tell you are so wonderful. But then...
well, when they're driving along in a jeep looking for either a chameleon or a lion to show you,
yes,
and they don't have anything because they're hunting, they're using, you know, they're tracking, literally. They're
right.
using tracks.
Yes.
They tell stories, they tell tales, yes. and they are, and these are people who have served in many different parts of Africa. They are native, their politics, one refers to the former government and farmers and people in South Africa. He says, to put it mildly, they are pigs. And it's like, oh, why don't you tell us what you really think?
Well, it depends upon where you are in Africa. Some places, guides have to be a bit more reticent. There's
this is Kruger
danger of speaking the truth.
Well, this is in Kruger National Park in the Sabi Sands. And no doubt they are funded by extremely wealthy tourists. But this is a protected animal environment.
Right.
The people do not go there to hunt. They hunt the way you do, with cameras.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's lovely. It is a remarkable experience to do any of that kind of thing. I am, as a journalist and as a photographer, when I've been in those kind of environments, I have to admit I have been in a very privileged situation, because people will bend over backwards to help me. And
that's the word you hear.
Some of the walks I've had, or some of the crazy experiences I've had.
Kenya especially, I would imagine.
Oh, Papua New Guinea, going away from Africa, was one of the most remarkable experiences. When Daniel and I were there, we were in the Sepik region, which is one of the most remote areas in the world. I understand that the time we were there, fewer than 5,000 outsiders had ever been there. There's one wonderful story I have to tell you. It's absurd. I mean, it's classic kind of story. When we were headed to Papua New Guinea, because of our connection at the tech world, you remember Comdex, the predecessor to CES? It was the big high-tech trade show in Las Vegas. Daniel and I were on a press bus, and I had no idea who the product was. All I knew is they were giving us rides to our next meeting. And I was very pleased. And Daniel said to me, whispered in my ear, ask the head PR guy, how remote is remote? I said, okay, I have no idea why Daniel's telling me that. How remote is remote? And it turned out they had a product called Remote, which was one of the early modem connection communication products out there to use telephones to connect telephones to laptops so you could communicate with other laptops.
Right.
And so we were on our way to Papua New Guinea at the time, and then we had several other assignments to Amazon and Africa and another one to the Antarctic. And so right then, when Daniel explained what we were about to do, and he said, why don't you have Sally do some photography with your product boxes in these various environments with a laptop and a phone and the whole bit. They loved the idea. At midnight, after all of us had finished our meetings, we were in a hotel food court, and we negotiated this relationship that I would to go photograph, do all these photographs. So I did it in Devil's Island. I did it in Madagascar. I mean, all over the place. And in Papua New Guinea, they had a problem called the Rascals. Rascals were, they sound very mischievous. They were actually very violent gangs who were terrorizing the countryside. And the government couldn't control them. So what they did was they approached the leader of the most powerful Rascal gang and gave him his own village.
Hmm.
To bring him into the ownership of wanting to protect the countryside rather than raid it. Well, so we met this guy. And just this moment, I know his name as well as yours, Jim, and I can't think of it right now. So let's just say I called him John. I don't remember what his name. Anyway, so I wanted to do a photograph of him with a laptop and a phone. He was in full native regalia, not the dressy regalia, but just his everyday. And it was in a wonderful jungle environment. And so I negotiated a fee to photograph him. He said, would you like the do it in the spirit house? Well, the spirit house is this dark, dark thatched hut, which is the center of any village. It's the heart of any village. But it's very dark in there. I said, I can't really photograph inside the hut. I didn't have a bunch of lights with me, and it would have been inappropriate anyway. I said, but we could do it outside the hut if that's okay. He said, yes. So we negotiated another price. This guy was very savvy about negotiating. Then he said, would you like my grandfather in the picture? I said, well, I'd like to meet your grandfather. He brings out a skull from the spirit house.
Oh, God, yeah.
And then he tells me the story that a neighboring village had raided them, had gone to war with them, and stolen his grandfather's skull. And so he had to go to battle with them to steal it back. So, of course, I had to have the skull in the picture. So I negotiated another price. Then he said, would you like to have a young lady in the picture? Well, the young lady was a very nubile young woman who was going to be his fourth wife. And she was very
simultaneously
pretty.
Serially?
Yeah, and concurrent, you know, this was you know, his harem.
Exactly.
And so we negotiated a price. Then he said, would you like her bare-breasted? And that's where I stopped. I said, this is for advertising for the United States. As much as I know she would be very attractive bare-breasted, it's not what we need for this photograph. And so the negotiation stopped, and we started doing the photography. But these were the kinds of crazy things that came out of this photo negotiation on a bus and then midnight in a food court.
Right.
And so when you think about those kinds of experiences, and people tell me that I talk about that things are so visual in my writing. Well, this is part of the creative chaos, these kinds of experiences.
And it's also the kind of experience that allows you to create world build.
Yes, very much
which
so.
Which is very much what you do in The Winter Boy.
Yes, yes. I love world building. I live in those worlds. I wonder what people do with their lives who don't have all these characters and worlds inside them. It must be so boring.
No, I can tell you exactly what they do.
Yes.
They read your books.
Oh, that's nice. I like that. I like that. It's fun. Yeah, I'm one of those writers that love writing. I mean, I love writing. I love rewriting. I love rewriting the rewrites.
I think it needs to be said that nobody chooses to write speculative fiction if they don't care for it.
True, true. But there are a lot of people who love speculative fiction and love having written, but don't like the process of writing.
Yeah.
Quite a few authors actually will say it's excruciating.
Mm-hmm.
I do not find it so. I find it energizing and exciting. And it's just, in fact, when I'm not either writing or creating pictures, frankly, I forget who I am because I'm so alive when I'm doing that. I love it.
Well, I think that's an excellent cue to hear chapter one of The Winter Boy.
That sounds good to me.
Yeah. Now, we were actually, this is like our fourth or fifth attempt to get you on the air. A lot of them were just bad timing. And then you came over to my house, where the sound quality is often better than here at WBAI. The room I'm in is not soundproofed at all. The door is open, the ceiling, the walls do not go up to the ceiling. It's very bizarre. I actually get better sound often out of my house. And we recorded an entire show. No, let me rephrase that. We spoke an entire show there.
Mm-hmm.
We spoke for about an hour or so, just like we have now. And then you read chapter one of The Winter Boy. That
I believe it was a couple of the first chapters because they're short, the first few chapters.
Yeah, I think
in the reading.
So.
Yeah.
Well, one way or the other, it runs 25 minutes and 16 seconds. And the point being, though, that we lost. I lost somehow the beginning. There was something. My recorder is usually extremely reliable. There are times when it screws up, and this was one of those times where I wasn't paying enough attention to the record button or something. You see, it always shows a level, whether it's on, whether it's recording or not. I can hear in the headphones, and I can see the levels. Only it wasn't recording. So, but we did get the reading, and I think that it is time to listen to it. Do you not?
It sounds like a good idea to me.
Okay, so let me mention, Sally, that I am going to turn off the potentiometer, that is to say the volume on the Skype call. So if you wish to speak to me during this, you can call my mobile.
Okay.
And I will bring up the pot after we listen to the reading. Okay. And let me mention, by the way, to listeners that this is indeed WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and wending its way through the world on WBAI.org. So having done a proper break there, we will now hear Sally Wiener-Grotta. I think you introduce yourself in it for the byline with the beginning of The Winter Boy. Well, that is if I can get the darn... Oh, you know, this always happens to me. This is sabotage-y. Everything is turned up. The pot is turned up, but somebody turned off the volume on the player. So let's pretend that I'm introducing this again for the first time. Just rewind. I'm not in shape to do my sound effects. This is The Winter Boy.
Chapter 1 of The Winter Boy by Sally Wiener-Grotta. The valley of the Alleshi stretches wide and green, surrounded by gentle mountains that cut the coldest of winds from the north and the wildest of hurricanes from the south. In the spring, summer, and fall, the eight passes to the valley flow constantly with pilgrims, traders, petitioners, and emissaries, and of course Alamin, the leaders of the land trained by the Alleshi. But in winter, heavy snow fills the high mountain passes. Only during those deep, white months is the valley isolated and inaccessible. It is a precious, quiet season for the Aleshi. As one such season approached, Roshana had just returned home from a strengthening class at the communal hall when she saw Dara through her mudroom window. Dara was tall and lean, with flesh deeply etched by life. Her black hair was streaked with wide swathes of white. With precise, practiced grace, she walked up to the back door, raised her hand to knock, then noticed Roshana standing inside, so she opened the door and walked in. "Dara, you're early!" Why was her mentor here now, before she could bathe and prepare herself for their daily meeting? "I'm not staying long." Dara followed Roshana into the spacious, sun-filled kitchen and sat at the square oak table. Obviously, Dara had something on her mind that she felt couldn't wait. "Yes?" Roshana asked as she sat down across from Dara. Her exercise suit was sweat-stained and itched. She raked the wet strands of her auburn hair that were escaping the tie-back ribbon, pushing them behind her ears. Then, realizing what she was doing, she draped her hands onto her lap, forcing her body to be still and receptive. "It's time for you to choose your first boy," Dara said with deliberate calm, her dark, age-yellowed eyes fixed on Roshana's. "I saw a worthy candidate this morning, the son of one of my alemen. The boy could prove interesting for you." "My first season isn't supposed to be until the spring," Roshana protested. "I'm not ready." "Of course you are, or I wouldn't suggest it." "What if I'm not, Dara? A boy's entire future depends upon what I do, how well I'm prepared." "You know you won't be alone. I'll guide you through your first season." "I don't understand," Roshana paused, trying to sort her thoughts. "Everyone has drilled into me how tightly structured my training schedule must be to fit everything I need to know into 3 years. Why would you now want to cut it short by 4 months?" And so suddenly, she studied her mentor, trying to read Dara's face and body the way she'd been taught. "Is there something special about this boy?" "No, not at all, Roshana," Dara reassured her. "We're simply very pleased with how quickly you've learned. Waiting until the spring won't prepare you any better, but it would delay teaching you the finer points of being an Alesha, which you'll learn only by working with a boy in season. Trust me, the timing is right." The younger woman nodded, not so much in agreement as acceptance. Of course she trusted Dara. Faith in the wisdom and power of the Alesha was the foundation of her life, of their entire society. "I don't have your experience or knowledge, Dara. I wouldn't know how to select a boy. Can't I simply accept this candidate if you think he's the right one for me?" Dara arched her back against the offensive suggestion. "Absolutely not! This is a decision only you can make. However, I can help you analyze what type of boy to choose for your first, which will define the kind of Alesha you wish to become." "What do you mean?" "Let me explain by telling you about this candidate." Dara focused on something only she could see in the empty air between them. "Unlike most Alamon sons, he's a rough one, arrogant, a bit of a troublemaker. Still, he is bright and alert." Dara's voice was as disciplined as ever, enunciating each word clearly, forcefully. However, she paused between phrases more than usual, carefully considering each word before she said it. "He'll constantly try to provoke and test you, attempting to control rather than learn from you. But if you can reach him, as I believe you can, his strength of will, intelligence, and good heart could be of great value to our people." "Sounds like a strong candidate." Roshana wondered why her mentor seemed to be holding herself in tight check. Perhaps Dara was being careful not to unduly influence her in this important decision. "Yes, but only a few Alesha are willing or capable of taking on such a difficult boy. I was appointed your mentor because we believe you have within you that ability. and because problem boys have been my specialty. But you're under no obligation to follow in my ways. Should you select another kind of boy for your first, I will still work through the season with you. It is your choice. How do I decide, Dara? By meeting him, then evaluate your reaction. Does his coarse manner irritate you, or can you find humor and challenge in it? What do you see beyond the face he presents? Is it something intriguing that you'd enjoy unearthing, though the process would be difficult? Look into your heart, Dara continued. Do you want to give a piece of it to this troublesome boy? Remember, once you are an Alesha to a boy, he becomes part of you, and that will change you. You must be honest about yourself, who you are and what you want, both for the moment and for the course of your life. To choose a boy such as this one means that your first Aleshine season, and seasons to come, will be filled with conflict and stress. You will have to learn to be fierce while instilling gentleness. It will wear you out before your time. There's no harder work, but also none more important. What if I choose another kind of boy for my first? Roshana asked. Most boys aren't like this one. They're confused, mischievous, but willing to bend and eager to learn. Seasons with them start joyously and proceed toward harmony. Not much of a choice, is it? Even as she said it, Roshana wondered why the words somehow didn't ring true. Who wouldn't choose a life of joy and harmony over one of conflict and stress? I, for one, and possibly you. Dara sighed, a wistful smile softening her face. Once you've moved past the conflict, once you've harnessed a problem boy's energy with discipline, the alamin you create can become one of our most powerful and effective. Easy-to-train boys are fine for those times when you want to relax, but I couldn't have given all of my seasons and years to languid pleasure. I devoted my life to fire and stone, and with each of my problem boys, I became stronger, more alive. Dara's smile broadened, deepening the wrinkles around her mouth, and yet, for that brief moment, making her seem young once more. And I couldn't be prouder of the alamin they have become. I see. You've given me a lot to consider, Dara. I'll leave now, so you can meditate on your decision. After your bath, prepare a simple lunch, one that won't distract you from your thoughts. Then sit under one of your apple trees among the fallen leaves. I'll be back in late afternoon. Soon after, the Southwest Batai will come with the boy. Meeting him places no obligation on you, but will help you think things through. Roshana was already deep in thought, weighing what Dara had said, and trying to decide what hadn't been said. When Dara left as quietly as she could, on her way out, the older woman made sure that the outer front door of the house was closed, as a sign that Roshana wasn't accepting visitors. Chapter 2. Ivania! Karine greeted her friend warmly at her kitchen door. The two women always used the names of their youth when they were alone together, names from so long ago that no one else in the valley remembered them. One look at Ivania's shadowed face, and Karine knew something momentous had happened. Silently, they secured the house and sequestered themselves inside the locked inner room, safe from eavesdroppers. They spoke in hushed staccato tones, compressing sound deep in their throats, though they knew no one could hear them. "The boy has arrived," Ivania said. Karine's breath caught in her lungs. "So soon? We weren't expecting him until spring." "Mistra and Shriya had no choice if we didn't want to chance losing him." Ivania shivered, though the room was warm. "He's determined to marry his girl. He had actually gone to their village council to announce their betrothal. If Mistra hadn't managed to get the girl's mother to block him. But no woman speaks at the Barani Council." She's a widow with no man to speak for her, so the council had to listen and honor her decision. Which was? An alimony for my daughter or no man. I'm impressed. We should keep an eye on the mother and see if she has the makings of an Alesha. Corrine struggled to rearrange her small round body, trying to find a comfortable position. The inner room wasn't meant for women whose bones were no longer flexible, regardless of how well padded they had become. Perhaps it could be a good thing that he's arrived, that the waiting is over.
Hold on. And then pick it up from... This one's a little low, this plane's. Take it from perhaps. And one, two...
Pardon me, this should have been edited.
Perhaps it could be a good thing that he's arrived, that the waiting is over. Still, I'm concerned about the timing. I thought we'd have longer to train her. 4 months could have made such a difference. Ivania paused. There's so much she doesn't know, doesn't yet understand. And she's so young. She sighed deeply. Chapter 3. In the nearly 3 years that she had been training in the valley, Roshana had learned much about what it was to be an Alesha. She had studied how to control with the turn of a hand, to seduce with a glance, to disarm with a smile. Lessons with various Aleshian teachers had focused her eye to read the subtle signs in another's behavior, gestures, and voice. Other Aleshi taught her self-defense and ways to avoid the need to defend. She'd spent untold hours absorbed in the valley's extensive library. Guided by Sava, Jared's Alesha, she had researched history, trade, treaties, and the cultures of the diverse peoples within and beyond the peace borders, seeking hints about the long-ago hidden time before the Great Chaos. Combining her new skills, observations, and growing knowledge, she had practiced a range of responses to many different scenarios, altering her approach, posture, and tone to achieve the most beneficial outcome. All this time, Roshana's every waking moment had been consumed by the study and practice of the many disciplines required to become a successful Alesha. But now that Dara had set Roshana's mind in a new direction, she realized that her tight focus had distracted her from considering wider, more personal ramifications. They had been training her to face this moment since she had come to the valley with her petition. Her teachers had been chosen carefully to set the path of her life. Their aim was now as clear as that of an arrow knocked into a bow by a master archer. Why hadn't anyone said anything to her, not even Sava? Problem boys, problem life. Certainly the challenges of such a future could be fascinating. But how dare they twist her training without asking her what it was she wanted? Until now, at this late hour, when they felt confident of her answer. Confident because they had already formed her into the Alesha they wanted her to be. How like the Aleshi! And now she was one of them. No, she yelled into the empty house, startling herself with the sound, but feeling a certain satisfaction in the solid autonomy of her own voice. Arrogant, manipulative, overbearing. I won't be like her. She shook her head to clear it. Jinnit, pull yourself together, she demanded of herself, using her name from before her life before the valley. Remember who you are and why you came here. It had been 5 years ago this spring, but often it felt like yesterday. Jared's mutilated body carried home to her after that long winter wait. Bathing her husband for the last time and finding under the dried blood and encrusted dirt the gruesome geometric patterns carved into his flesh. Murktig Zalag runes. Pushing the memory deep inside where she kept it locked away, Roshana straightened her back and closed her eyes. Then she took 5 deep, long breaths, releasing herself into each exhale. When she opened her eyes, she probed inward and found the knot of her anger. No, it would not be easily dislodged, but she didn't have to lose herself to it. Roshana stomped into her bedroom, tore off her sweaty exercise clothes, and began the daily ritual of studying herself in the mirror. The body she saw in her reflection was not the one of her youth. That had been the first difficulty for her when Sava had explained the importance of the wall-sized mirror in every Alesha's bedroom. But her teachers had insisted she persevere. Eventually she had learned to evaluate her own body, wielding that knowledge in the way she carried herself. All Aleshian skills began with this understanding of the physical self, a tool to be utilized, a power to be harnessed. But she had naively believed that the Aleshi would never use their skills on one another, on her. Now she felt like a fool. Yet still she obeyed by standing in front of the mirror, honoring the teachings of those who had not honored her. All in all, it was an attractive, womanly figure that Roshana saw in the mirror, one that had given life to two children and had reached the ripeness of maturity. Roshana's 43 years had taken their toll, and her shapely legs might widen toward the curvy hips a bit more than she would like, but they were elegant and could be used to good effect. Her arms, too, had that graceful length that made her the motions and gestures she practiced in the mirror appealing. Though her breasts had become weighty rather than round, and her waist would never again be the hourglass indent it had once been, her body was tightening nicely thanks to Mikhail's exercises. She was pleased that her shoulder-length auburn hair now shone with the highlights of her youth, thanks to the new henna rinse Hester had given her. And her skin was responding well to the lemon juice and olive oil treatments, helping to repair the years of sunburn and hard work. Not that anything would ever erase those freckles. Roshana continued to stare into the mirror. If you can see a person's heart and destiny in her eyes, what did hers reveal about the Alesha she wanted to be? Had the Alesha changed her so fully that she no longer had any choices that truly came from within her? Or was the woman who stared back at her still the free-born, independent individual she had always considered herself to be? Retreating into her steaming bath, Roshana gave herself fully to the sensual pleasure of it and used it to clear her mind. As she dressed and prepared a lunch of fruit, cheese, and bread, she turned her mind back to the question of her first boy and to the Aleshi. Later, she sat among the fallen leaves under the largest of her house-tall apple trees, nibbled at the meal, and considered her choices. While her mind tugged her toward rebellion, she had shaped her day according to Dara's instructions. Bath, meditation, lunch under the tree. And she recognized no contradiction in such behavior. Obedience to the Aleshi was deeply ingrained in her, as it was among all people and villages within the peace borders. Starting in early childhood, all were taught not to give in to anger, but to follow whatever path the Aleshi decreed, until free will, unfettered by destructive emotions, could be restored. A child of the peace, she obeyed. The resentment Roshana felt about being manipulated to choose a hard life, one devoted to problem boys, remained strong, but less emotional. She examined that anger as she studied her body in the mirror, and there, at the core of her being, where her ire had formed, she found her answers. She was calm and sure by the time Dara returned. Chapter 4. Dara sat beside Roshana under the apple tree between Roshana's house and barn. A gentle breeze stirred the brown leaves on the ground, tossing them to the cloudless sky. Neither spoke, nor did they look at each other. Instead, both leaned against the tree's rough, solid trunk, staring in different directions. Roshana took her time forming the words she wanted to say. They had to be simple, but effective. "I was angry with you," Roshana said quietly. "I know," Dara responded, just as calmly. "You and the others have worked hard to form me as you needed me to be." "Yes. Your chisel chipped at the stone of my being until you whittled me down to my essential self, as if I were a problem boy." Dara turned toward her charge. "I knew you would understand." But Roshana's sight remained focused outward and elsewhere. "Yes, I understand. But I wonder, have you ever been wrong? What if under that stone you found a softness and nature that required a gentler touch?" "Under the stone is always a softness, Roshana. It is in such softness that true strength is revealed." "So now I must choose. Do I wish to work with boys in whom I would use a similar chisel? Or do I want to use water on clay?" "Yes. A boy to be chiseled is harder work," Roshana considered in the same cruel, apprising tone. "But the result is a stone-core strength, a man of unusual power. A man not unlike the woman you are." Roshana was surprised to hear it, but still didn't turn toward Dara. Instead, she allowed her eyes to glaze over, hearing the meaning under the rhythm of the words, finding the truth that had been there all alone. Dara leaned back against the tree. "The other kind of boy would shape under my hands with little resistance," Roshana continued, "and with a great deal of joy and pleasure. Yet you have known that I would choose stress and conflict." "Because it is what will give you the greater joy and pleasure in the end." "No, because you knew the kind of woman you had shaped. The kind of woman you've always been." "You assume much." "Yes. And now I am the same as you." "Yes." "How will I know I'm making the right choices for my boys?" "You will know, or you will come to those of us who know. It is in your blood as well as in your training." "So I will take this boy whom you have chosen." "Only if you wish it. Your will has always been your own to command." "A free will shaped by you." "No. One unearthed by us, Roshana. It is your essential self that will be doing the choosing. We only helped you understand the shape of that self. Yet before I make my choice, you already know what it will be." "Yes. Because you know me even more intimately than I have known myself?" "Because I recognized you as my successor before anyone else, and I had been waiting long for you." "Perhaps too long, Dara. Perhaps you have seen in me what you needed and wanted to see." "No. I saw in you what you needed and wanted to be." "I understand, but a part of me is still angry with you." "Yes. What am I to do with that anger?" "Accept it and use it. Without it, you would not have the free will we cherish and need. It is the inner conflict that will prepare you for the many conflicts ahead." "So it's already decided?" "Yes." "And it's my decision?" "Yes." "Yes." Roshana looked up at the blue sky framed by the Sentinel Mountains. A solitary, small white cloud drifted in the wind. It was a sharp, clean day, with summer a long-ago memory. Winter wouldn't be held at bay much longer.
And you have been listening to Sally Wiener Grotta reading from the beginning of her novel, The Butcher Boy.
And this is WBAI New York, the show's Hour of the Wolf. I'm Jim Freund, and we have Sally Grotta on the phone.
Hello. Am I still back here?
Yes, you are back. You are back on the air.
Great. Let me turn off the WVIA. Okay, now. Okay. I was getting echo. I guess it was from your end.
Well, the echo would be because the internet feed always has lag.
Well, no, I turned off the internet feed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's always strange listening to your own voice.
Yes, it is. I, even after all these many years of radio, I still shudder. I still shudder when I hear me.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But it's fun returning to the world. I'm always, they're my old friends.
Yeah. So how long did it take you to write that?
Forever. Forever.
And a day.
I did not work on it consistently initially, so that I came up with the idea, more than a decade before it was published. But as it grew, I became more obsessed with it and spent more time on it. So the number of hours, I couldn't tell you. As I said, I'm a very slow writer because my first draft is always me telling myself the story. And it's a bit enchanting. And I do have a difficulty initially coming up with really violent things or ugly things, which are quite necessary in any plot. So the second draft is usually me sharpening the story. And then after that, it's sculpting and re-sculpting and re-sculpting until I'm satisfied. Or, yeah, no, until I'm satisfied. There comes a point at which one feels comfortable. Then I turn it over to people I trust, my editors and to readers.
So you have beta readers?
Oh, certainly. I also workshop friends. And of course, Daniel was integral to the whole process. He was such a brilliant critic and editor. He was always my first editor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It takes me a long time to write. I apologize to my readers about that because I know they're waiting for Sex Witch, which is the sequel to The Winter Boy.
Right.
It will be a standalone sequel. I don't believe in that thing where you have to have read books before to be able to enjoy a book. But it will be about Roshana away from the Valley of the Eleshi.
Right.
And there are several books planned within that world, but I also have several books planned in the world of JoJo. And I am in the middle of a completely unrelated novel right now. I am proud of Winter Boy. It got some pretty cool recognition. It was a nominee for the Locus Award, which was very, very cool. And I recently heard from CIFWA, from Science Fiction Writers of America, that it's going to be part of its fantasy story bundle this autumn, which is quite an honor.
That's a relatively new thing they're doing, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah. Where you can buy, something like 4 or 5 books are selected for the bundle, and you can have the right to read all of them. And it's a very reasonable price for the reader, and to introduce you to books that they feel are worth a larger readership.
I assume that's in ebook format that they'll be doing that?
As I understand it, yes, it is in ebook format. And they're going to have a science fiction bundle this spring, and then the fantasy bundle in the autumn. Winter Boy I've never been good at coloring within the lines. Some people call it fantasy, but there is no magic. There are no dragons. There are no deus machinas.
But it's fantasy in the same way that Ellen Kushner's Riverside books are fantasy. It exists in a world that doesn't exist.
Exactly. That it's for sake of categorizing is a fantasy novel.
Yeah, it's a work of the imagination.
Yes, that it is.
So, as such, it qualifies as speculative fiction.
Yes.
Which was a term when it was first coined, was intended to mean only hard science fiction.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, the people have funny ideas about where the term speculative fiction comes from. They think it's new. They think it's like in the last 20 years. But in fact, it was coined by Robert Heinlein in 1946.
Oh, my. I did not know that.
And he coined it in Astounding Magazine, referring very specifically that, you know, that you would speculate about science. And he wrote fantasy as well, but he invoked that term. He came up with that term to mean hard science fiction, just the same way that the term sci-fi was coined to mean monster movies. People forget that. It was coined by Forrest J. Ackerman in the magazine Famous Monsters of Filmland, and he said, let me be clear, these are not science fiction, this is sci-fi.
Okay.
It was So
that's why so many aficionados are offended by the term sci-fi.
It is. Well, yes. I've sort of given it up. Because it's now like two generations past, or at least one generation past, the people that just used that term thinking that it was a shortcut. But for some 25 years before that, it was understood that it referred to, at first, a certain kind of monster movie, low budget kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then there was good sci-fi. An example of good sci-fi was Star Wars. The original Star Wars, it was not called A New Hope. The original Star Wars from 1977 was sci-fi. It was dualistic, good versus evil, and that was it. But it was about that time also that people started thinking that sci-fi was just an abbreviation, because the mainstream got a hold of the concept that science fiction wasn't just Star Trek and Buck Rogers. Mm-hmm. It was now also Close Encounters and Star Wars, and so and 2001: A Space Odyssey in retrospect. And so they finally started to used the term in the newspapers, and they abbreviated it. The abbreviation that the SF community uses was SF, or right, sometimes SFF. If we wanted to refer to something as sci-fi, we said skiffy.
Yes, yes.
That's really skiffy.
Yes.
Yeah, look
at in the literary world, or the mainstream world, there is a great deal of snobbery against SF or fantasy. And when they like a novel, they will call it speculative. If they like a science fiction or fantasy novel, they will call it speculative. So that a number of reviewers have called The Winter Boy speculative literary novel.
Well,
they
accept it, but it's also a very good term. It was sort of recoined, I think, to cover indefinable writing, like, say, Kelly Link. Who you can't say is science fiction, who you can't say is fantasy, but you also can't say that it's realistic fiction. It's
right.
And it's not necessarily just surreal. So the old bugaboo of speculative fiction, as coined by had been coined by Heinlein, began to re-evolve.
Yes.
Just the same way that sci-fi evolved from a negative put-down term to an abbreviation for stuff. But then, you know, now they call comic book movies sci-fi, but they're not. Doctor Strange is not sci-fi. Mm-hmm. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's not science fiction. It be fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There is magic afoot.
Yes.
But they call it sci-fi. So, but as the late David Hartwell once said, science fiction is the wrong and only good name for it.
Marvelous. He had a way. Yes, that's very good.
And Damon Knight said, science fiction is what I'm pointing at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another great definition. Yeah. And so, I like the term speculative fiction, because what else would you call it? Imaginative literature?
Right.
All good literature is imaginative.
I would hope so.
But the thing about sci-fi is, that anybody who really reads the stuff and understands the stuff, we were talking about Pynchon earlier. Pynchon, he wrote a lot of stuff that can easily be classified as science fiction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it is a dishonor to say that Thomas Pynchon writes sci-fi.
Yeah.
And God knows Margaret Atwood doesn't care for that.
Yeah.
She even disdained the term science fiction for a long time until she duked it out in literary journals with Le Guin and Le Guin won, as Le Guin will generally do.
Yes. She's a tough bird. Marvelous woman.
She is. She's not always right about certain things, but she was right about that one.
I was very privileged. I actually workshopped with her for a couple of weeks few years ago. That was a fabulous experience.
Yeah. I've interviewed her twice. The first time was horrible because all I did was gush.
Yes.
Just like, wow, you're Ursula K. Le Guin. And she's going, yeah, I guess. So, you know, not my best interview. And that was over the phone. Next time I interviewed her, she came into New York and we hit it off and we just recorded for 3 hours.
Marvelous.
And it was great.
You've done some fabulous interviews.
I have. And some of them have been washed away.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I will do a complete 2-hour show just kvetching about that and bitching about that a lot. Because a lot of good stuff, including a lot of old WBAI radio, some of which predates me, tapes that belong to Baird Searles, and people forget a music director who worked at WBAI, worked at KPFA, Anthony Boucher.
Mm.
So people in science fiction and mystery worlds know the name Anthony Boucher very well. And I had his tapes. Some of those hopefully are in the Pacifica archives, but the ones I had were the masters. And I don't know if any copies of those, of some of those exist. They were music shows, but he would say, but they, he had a, He was a horrid punster, or a very good punster, depending on your point of view, and would say something like, "We're now going to hear the only existing recording of a castrato." For those who are unaware, castrati are people who were cut out to be opera singers.
Oh, ooh, ooh.
That was typical of him.
I've always appreciated good puns because they require intelligence and they're the gentlest of humor. I'm not a person who likes victim humor.
Oh, you know, yeah.
Cruel
yeah.
humor.
Yeah.
And punning is just intelligent play with words. I guess authors will always enjoy someone who can understand the different levels of words.
Yes, exactly. But if I ever tell a victim type joke, I turn the victim into an alien.
That's nice. Poor aliens.
You know those Venusians? Well, let me tell you something.
Yeah. I just don't like cruelty. That's it's something I have to force myself to do in my writing.
You and I both. And I got to say, so many movies. Ugh. You know.
I can't watch horror movies. I can't even. I have a difficulty reading horror also because I do have perfect suspension of disbelief.
Well,
which is why I get so involved in my worlds because I can suspend my own disbelief so fully.
I used to say that I couldn't stand horror, but now I understand since I am also the audio editor of Nightmare Magazine, which is all horror. It's not horror that I dislike, it's body horror.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are horror movies like The Haunting, one of the great horror movies of all time, edited, of course, not edited, but directed by Robert Wise. Mm-hmm. It is a thoroughly brilliant, frightening film.
Well, you see, that's fear. Actually, the mind fear.
Yeah, there's no gore in it.
But I have perfect suspension of disbelief so that things start creeping at me. I get very creepy. I get very scared. I get truly, truly scared like a little kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't like that feeling. I don't like being terrified.
Yes, I understand exactly what you're talking about. To me, that is not entertainment.
Yeah.
And you know, the reason I'm reading, the reason I'm watching television, movies and stuff is to be entertained. So, no, I'm not there for Game of Thrones. I love George Martin's writing, but no, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Can't watch that. Can't.
It is a brilliant series of books, though. My God, talk about world building. Yeah, oh, my goodness.
The world building is great, but, you know.
I don't know how he keeps track of all those characters. That is an impossible feat.
Yeah, but I couldn't easily read those either. Because they are. Listen, believe it or not, 2 hours have passed.
Oh.
We are out of time.
Well, this has been great fun. It's always fun chatting with you, Jim.
Thank you.
And I'm so glad we finally got it on air.
Yeah. So where do people find you online and The Winter Boy and your other work?
I have several websites, grotta.net, grotta.net, crossingthetribaldivide.com. I'm on Facebook, Sally Wiener Grotta. Wiener is spelled like a hot dog. And my books are available everywhere. Please buy them.
Yes, absolutely. And I recommend to most people just go to grotta.net because that leads to all the other things you just mentioned.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, thank you, Sally. I'll be seeing you in a couple of weeks.
Yes, and thank you.
April 1st. Okay, have a good morning. Take care. And everybody else, thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I will be back next week with a very interesting experimental program with NS. Ooh, what is the pseudonym that he currently uses, Dolkart, D-O-L-K-A-R-T. We're going to ask you all to read stuff on the air. You're going to call up, read stuff on the air, and if you start cracking up during the reading, and this is intentionally bad writing, you lose. What do you lose? Nothing. You end up laughing. You have a good time, one way or the other. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you all for listening. You can find me at a very old website, hourwolf.com, soon to be revitalized. And I, too, am on Facebook. There's an Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook. And we're here every Wednesday morning from 1 to 3 a.m., except when we're not. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way in just a few moments.
I am a revolutionary, and you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the red, white, and the blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the peace work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Panama, talking about Peru. Azania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag.
Not before.
That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle the Star Spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Land the free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I touch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
just remembers every day. Yeah. When I play my troubles away, you stay. I said music's my desire. Set my heart on fire now. Music is my desire. It's what I require now. Oh yeah. Oh Lord. Music is my desire. It set my heart on fire now. Music is my desire. It's what I require now. Oh yeah. Oh Lord.
List alive, WBAI, flag burning time, make it 10 minutes after, 10 minutes after 3 o'clock right here, 99.5, 99 Single, List Alive. It's good to be back, thank you very much Jim Fine for sitting in last week. Point 5 minutes after 3 o'clock. Jim Fine, thank you very much for sitting in last week. Had to do some running on the beach. Yeah. Yeah. With my partner. Trevor Dyer out in California, IA. Jeffrey Chung producing, Pablo Moses, Jeffrey Chung on keyboards and arrangements and all that good stuff. The man who produced the Ija Man album that you love so much, you know what I mean? Yeah. Michael Rose on the radio right here. Yeah. Michael Rose on the radio right here. When Black Uhuru was Michael Rose.
I'm gonna sit in my house and wonder what to do. But this South African here in the morning time, oh my little,